This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
It is great to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. This is your chance to catch up on something you might have missed or hear again, some of your favourite experts, brilliant advice and real life stories too. Now, the pandemic has led to some interesting business opportunities, some ideas that may not have come to fruition or act as a catalyst for others. Opportunities for citizenship and second passports internationally has noticed a huge uptick. So we were in conversation with one man who could answer my questions and yours about getting that second passport. John Hannafin heads up Haraya Private, who says citizenship, we're looking for that second passport or even getting some residency elsewhere. Well, there's a lot to be said for it. But what are the downside? He was taking our questions. Someone who has recently received that golden 10-year visa is Chef Izu Arni. He is a true inspiration, not just for his incredible food, but for his work ethic as well. We were in conversation with him, finding out about what it means to him to have this recognition and has it changed his plans. Speaking of plans, how do you feel about climbing the height of the Burj Khalifa? For a good cause, of course. Speaking to Anne Edmondson, chairwoman of Gulf for Good, about some challenges, both close to home, even your own home, and also further afield, where you can be pushing yourself to the limits and raising money for brilliant causes. And when it comes to big business, modest fashion is definitely a thriving niche. In conversation with an author, Hamza Lodi, her book about modest fashion being a fashion paradox is well worth a read. Speaking to her about what she's noticed around fashion changing in the region, and how big brands from the Western world are taking notice. And when it comes to spending, comes to retail, we have been speaking to Nancy Osbeck from Money Diaries recently. She was sharing her thoughts on saving versus spending and why she feels it's so important to support fellow working mums and women in retail in her space at Times Square Centre. And if you're thinking about freelancing, we have got you sorted. Toby Simpson of the Striver app was speaking to us about what you need to know, from the legalities and costs of setting up and running it as a business of one, to how you can leverage your network and get that first money in your bank account. Plus, a company that is setting up to help you set up as a freelancer. On Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It has been over a year of COVID chat, and the pandemic has certainly made us expats think about our families back home and what those countries are doing to protect them. And many of us choosing to stay here in Dubai because of a really robust, successful vaccination program that is free of cost. And of course, the rules that have been put in place to keep us safe as the economy continues to operate. And my guest today says the events of the past year have had an effect on where people want to take up citizenship. John Hannafin heads up Haraya Private and says citizen investment has seen an uptick. So curious to take your questions. We've got John with us talking about opportunities for citizenship and second passports internationally. John, thank you so much for being with us. How are you today?
Hi, Helen. How are you? Yeah, everything is great. Very good. Very, very busy. Thank you.
Busy is a blessing. That's a great thing. Lovely to hear that business is booming. Can you explain a little bit about why you think citizenship investment has seen an increase, certainly over the course of the last 12 months?
I think, very simply, when people became, it's an incredible situation that we're going through, and I think nobody in their current lifetimes, unless they lived through the Spanish flu, have been through what we're going through right now. And I think we never thought that we would see countries locking their borders and saying that you cannot come in, you cannot get out, and you cannot travel anywhere. Now, what we realized quickly when we were a month or two into this crisis was that citizens from certain countries were, of course, allowed to go back to their countries. If you happen to be a citizen, I work here with a Dutch colleague. He was in lockdown about 2 months, just to give you an example, in a small apartment on the Palm. The gyms were closed, the pools were closed, everything was closed, and he couldn't leave. And he decided to take himself, his wife, and his young child to the Dutch embassy in Abu Dhabi and request a flight back to Holland. He said, I'd prefer to stay there than be locked down here. And that was his choice as a Dutch citizen. And he was put on a plane the next day from Abu Dhabi and could return. And he spent 4 to 6 weeks of the next period before returning. So I think people then realized, I had a number of clients coming to me who were expatriates based here and said, look, if I had have proceeded with this passport application a year ago, I would actually be able to take lockdown, shall we say, in that foreign country, in my second country. And this applies also, of course, for people with permanent residency. So we had a lot of clients that had permanent residency in Cyprus, in Malta, in Greece, in Portugal. And they decided as well, just as the lockdown started, they requested a flight as a permanent resident of the country. They were allowed into the country even when the borders were closed. And that was one thing we never thought we would see as a business venture, should we say. I mean, I never thought people would come and say, I'm interested in acquiring second residency or citizenship because I fear a pandemic.
I know. There's opportunities coming up, certainly from the last 12 months. I'm with you. Could never have predicted this. This sounds like it's clearly for the wealthy, John. What kind of costs are we talking about in order to have second passport? Let's break it down.
Well, generally, I mean, if we look at, I break this down into two different categories. There's Europe and non-Europe, should we say. So traditionally, this industry was really thought of as being created by St. Kitts and Nevis 35, 37 years ago in the Caribbean. They came up with the concept of investing into their country, acquiring residency and being able to apply for a passport, for citizenship. Now that changed, you know, the number of citizens that were applying were generally high net worth people that were looking for a zero tax country to go and retire in. Now this changed dramatically when this country was given access to Schengen, because suddenly acquiring a passport from this jurisdiction would allow you easy access to 120 or 130 countries, including Europe and including the UK. So this really created the industry, and four other countries in the Caribbean, which people probably know about, Dominica, Grenada, St. Lucia, and who am I forgetting? Antigua. All have similar programs in that you can invest from $100,000 as a direct donation to a government-approved fund, or you can buy real estate. The real estate has to be held for a period of 5 years, after which you can resell the real estate and recoup the majority of your investment. Now, the real estate starts at $220,000. That's the government approved threshold. If you don't have enough capital, let's say that for a family of four, that would be on average $300,000-$350,000. But the direct donation tends to be more popular because it'd be less than half that amount. But it is a donation. Applicants say, look, it's money gone. It's not an investment. I said, well, it's an investment in your future and it's an investment in your family.
I just wanted to put a few questions to you. We've had a number coming in on the text line. Mark is saying here, my kids have got the chance to apply for dual nationality, the second country being an EU country where a grandparent was born. Just wondering, saying this would be very useful, given the chance to work, study, live in the EU, but are there any downsides or potential problems that they need to be aware of? What would you like to flag in that situation? Obviously, we think about the benefits being, freedom of movement, investment, tax. But when it comes to having dual passports, dual nationality in perhaps an EU country, and it sounds like Marcus is from the UK, what are the downsides or potential pitfalls that you need to be aware of before you start the process?
Potential pitfalls would be where your current passport is from. So if you are from a jurisdiction that won't allow dual citizenship, that's something to consider. So there are many countries around the world, many, many countries around the world, including around the GCC, that don't allow their citizens to have a second passport. So that's the first thing to consider. The second thing to consider would be, for me, taxation. Is it, like the USA, is it a country that's potentially going to tax you for the rest of your life, irrespective of where you live? Mm-hmm. Now, there are not very many countries in the world like that, USA being the primary one. Other than that, assuming Marcus, as you said, if he's British, then depending on what side of the Brexit vote he was on, he will have even more reason to apply because he's now from a non-European country. And he, under a British passport, cannot go live in Europe. He can go visit Europe for a period of 90 days, but he can't go live there.
Work-life balance on Afternoons with Helen Armour.
Talking passports and citizenship this afternoon, John Hannafin heads up Pariah Private, who says citizen investment has seen a significant uptick and more people are applying for a Portuguese passport than ever before. The UK seems to have lost a little bit of its appeal for those looking for a second passport. A number of messages coming in for you, John. Thank you for being with us today. So any questions, please do get in touch. You can be, of course, completely anonymous. Why do you think that Portuguese passport is proving to be a popular one?
I think the low entry rate. So Portugal started, let me give you a brief 30 seconds on it. So Portugal and Spain started permanent residency programs around about the same time, 7 years ago, basically to bring in foreign direct investment, to bring in capital from non-European investors. The success of Portugal really has been because they have adapted it over time. So it started 7.5 years ago, a 500,000 euro investment into real estate would grant you residency in Portugal, subject to due diligence, subject to biometrics, et cetera, et cetera. They then changed it and brought the threshold down to 350,000 euros into property that was more than 30 years old, which is generally all of the city centres of Porto and Lisbon. Mm-hmm. And then they brought the threshold down again to 280,000 euros to non-urban areas, so which they define as a 90-minute area outside of Porto and Lisbon, to try and diversify some of the investments out of the cities because it was becoming so popular. And now there are a number of hotel brands that have gone into the country to build large projects that have also got government approval. So you can actually invest into the likes of a Marriott or Hilton or the new Intercontinental, which is a government-approved hotel build with a guaranteed buyback. Now, I suppose the most appealing part of the program is you can become resident without living there, and you can potentially apply for a passport having lived only 35 days over 5 years. So 7 days a year you're required to be there.
And in Portugal, no hardship at all, especially if you like playing golf and eating food. all right, let's go to the text line, John, if you don't mind. No name on this one. As I said, you can be anonymous. Message saying, I'm Irish and my husband is Swiss. My daughter has a Swiss passport. Is it worth applying for an Irish one too? Are there any issues with it? Is it a complicated thing to do? And is it better to have one from a young age? She's less than a year old. I'm glad you asked this. I'm thinking about getting an Irish passport, thanks to my Irish mammy. What is that process, and what are the upsides, especially in this situation where husband is Swiss? Any insights, please?
I'll give you a literal example. So my wife is not Irish. Our boy was born here in the American hospital 10 years ago, maybe. And she's Polish. So my boy has Polish and Irish passports. No particular advantage. I mean, at the time, there was an advantage. Well, up until a year ago, there was an advantage because Irish passport was visa free to USA, for example. Mm-hmm. And the Polish passport was not visa free to USA. So if you wanted to go on holidays, there was an interview process to go to the American embassy, blah, blah, blah. Now, that has changed as of, I think, January this year, only this year. Swiss passport is an excellent passport. I've many Swiss friends that swear by it. And I would say if there's no tax disadvantage to having two passports, absolutely, absolutely, I would take it, particularly with Switzerland, because it's Europe, but it's not Europe. And most Europeans can't just walk into a canton in Switzerland and live there. You have to either have a job or make an agreement with the canton to go and pay your way in. But if I had the option to take a Swiss passport, I'd take one tomorrow. Absolutely.
All right, there you go. So, you know, why not? Safety in numbers. If you've got that option. Now, let's talk about the UAE's new rules on citizenship and residency now, John. Who is eligible for citizenship, and are you getting inquiries on this?
Okay, well, this is an interesting one. So I think on this subject as much as you know. So on the 30th of January, it was an amazing announcement by the ruler's court to state that there would be a certain section of society and residents here in Dubai that could apply for citizenship. Now, I think this came out about a year ago or 18 months ago, but it came with so many particular stipulations that it didn't become very popular and wasn't very newsworthy. It's now, so for example, 18 months ago, they announced that you could apply for a passport, but you had to drop your original passport. You had to learn Arabic, and there were other stipulations involved. It's now been changed as of 30th of Jan, and the UAE government will allow you to keep your original passport. And of course, it's subject to you being, how can I say this, a benefit to the country. So I printed out some of the documentation here from the EU website, from the government website here, the UAE website, talking about who it references. And this is skilled individuals, professionals, including artists. Now, these artists need to be, I went further into this. These are artists that have held shows that are established. And they'll also take anybody that works in science or has a PhD, but it needs to be a significant level of PhD. So they're trying to bring, I think, or trying to encourage the good and the great. And this relates, again, to the genius visa that was brought in maybe 2 years ago, and now to the 10-year permanent residency visa that was brought in. So somebody that invests 10 million plus into property or into his own investments here has the right to apply for a 10-year visa here in Dubai. And along with that, if they are of the right ilk, shall we say, they can also apply now for a UAE passport. But more details than this we don't have. So, yes, we've had many, many inquiries in February from all over the world, from people saying, listen, I'd love to get over there and I'd love to have a UAE passport. How does it work? But more information than this we don't have at the moment.
Well, John, do keep us posted. A really interesting time. And we are speaking next to Chef Izu Ani, who is a lucky and proud recipient of that 10-year golden visa. I'm waiting for my phone call. Yep. I'm putting the vibes out into the universe. But thank you so, so much. You can find more information at Haraya Private if you are looking at that option around citizenship and second passports indeed.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We've been talking about visas, second passports and citizenship here on Dubai I-103.8. Delighted to be joined now by Chef Izu Ani. He is one of Dubai's most beloved chefs, and he has just been granted that 10-year golden visa for his dedication and contribution to food scene here in the UAE. He is the man behind some of Dubai's most wonderful and, yes, some of my favourite restaurants. The list just goes on. In fact, we'll ask him, how many restaurants do you have now, Chef Izu? Come on. Time for a little bit of a humble brag.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
I was just waiting.
That's probably the first time you've ever not been speaking in your entire life. How are you, Chef?
I'm very well. Fantastic. It's always been good to be recognized, but to be recognized in a way like this, it puts you in a different step. It puts you in a different frame of mind. So yeah, I'm well, and the family are well. So yeah, they're a bit chuffed as well.
Of course they are. I mean, you're known for your massive smile. I'm sure you've just been grinning, grinning from ear to ear since getting that news. As I said, you are the man behind Karine, Gaia, some amazing collaborations, and working with hotel groups here as well. Now, you posted about this on social media saying it was a real honour to be recognised. And that's the great thing about it. It's the UA recognising your efforts, your contribution, your hard work. So what does it mean to you to have that recognition?
No, I mean, it's a fantastic recognition for in any books. I mean, just to be called up and be offered it, you can't apply for it. It's something that you have to be eligible with them recommending you. And this is what I've been saying from day one when I came here 11 years ago. If you do not invest yourself, you can't expect the way you live to invest in you. And this is, and it shows in your work, and this is kind of many years of hard work. And I know you asked me how many restaurants I have, and I should be bragging, but I've got a lot more than I'm letting you know that is coming up.
No.
There's a beauty coming. There's a beauty. I won't say anything, but this one is going to be very firmly in my heart. Actually, two of them. So, actually, three restaurants.
Honestly, the seconds ticking by and the restaurant count is going through the roof. But that's exactly it. It's proper hard graft that has,
exactly.
and you recognizing, the possibilities here in Dubai, putting Dubai like massively on the map. Not just about bringing in brands, but creating foodie concepts from the ground up. And you've been recognised not just by diners, but by royalty, by, celebrities. And even aside from that, people who just want to come back time and time again to eat your food.
But that's what it's all about. If you do not have that dedication to gain something or to push yourself to the limit, how do you expect things to change or to happen? And this is where Dubai allows us to dream bigger than we can even absorb. And this is where, when I came here, I saw my eyes have always been big. But being in a place, an environment that allows you to even dream bigger than you can even imagine, your capacity is endless. And this is where, being in a place which is like, it motivates you. And why not? And this is the kind of thing that I learned living in Dubai. Everything is possible. Why do you have to dream to be somewhere to make it? You can make it happen now and here. And to be recognized in this way, it makes me, it shows that hard work does pay, and investing who you are in the place you live, it does reward. And I think, and also, you hear a lot of the celebrities getting these golden visas, but it is possible for all of us to get it. That's what it is. It shows the recognition if you dedicate a lot of your time and effort, and where you call home is where you live. But also where you inspire to aspire, you aspire to inspire, mm-hmm. And this is what it's all about.
It is. And can I ask you a question? Yeah. I'm just curious. Well, first of all, how do you find out? Do you get a phone call and go, "Hello, chef, delighted to inform you." You go, "Hang on, this is a prank." How do you find out? Just so I'm ready for when Michael comes.
Honestly, I just got a phone call.
Really?
I literally got a phone call from the minister's office, and they said. And you have to submit, of course, a profile of who you are and what you've done. They know, but you still have to submit that. And then, one of the ministers assigned someone to basically walk you through the whole process. And I was invited to the Foreign Affairs office in near Deira, in Karama. And basically, I was met by the head of the police, and he gave me karak. He talked to me, showed me around. It was really surreal. I was like, it was an honor. It's something which you never expect. The kindness and the simple offering someone a tea, a coffee, and asking how it is, asking my opinion. It was really nice, and that is the moment I enjoy the most. Just sharing. That conversation. I didn't even know who he was. When I was walking into the building, he asked, "What are you here for?" And I said, "I'm here to collect my golden visa." And he goes, "Me golden? Are you sure? You don't want platinum or you don't want silver?" And he was like, it was beautiful. It made me feel so alert. So calm and all that, because it was quite, you feel honored, but also you feel a bit nervous because you've been called up for it. So, yeah.
It's the police. Can we still, please? I know you're a speed demon. I wonder if they'll waive a few of your fines over the last 11 years. Chef, I also wanted to ask you, I know you're on a bike more than the car these days. I wanted to ask you as well, does this change your plans at all? Has it changed the way you're thinking about your future in the UAE?
To be honest, no. I know some people might try and change the way they look at it, but for me, it's always been the same. I've always called here my home, because when you have a transit kind of mentality, you do not settle. You do not discover the potential you have, because you're always waiting to take the next plane. And me and my wife, myself and my wife, and we decided when I came here with La Petite Maison, we wanted to stay. Even when I left, we wanted to stay. We took I took the route of financing everything myself just to stay. I didn't want to take a job without understanding where I want to go. So we made plans. And when you make plans to live where you are, your imagination it has no limit. There's no boundaries. And to be honest, it's always been that way. If you look around the world now, where else can you live with a smile on your face every single day? And this is, I'm not saying it for any reason. It is. It's a place where you wake up, you see the sun, and the possibilities are there. You can't make it. I wake up, I go cycling. And I cycle. There's no way in the world I cycle that is as good as Dubai, because the roads are smooth and there's no cars. You're not dodging potholes. You're not dodging people trying to knock you over.
That's what I think when I go home. Incredible. Like, these roads are rubbish. It's like a patchwork quilt.
Exactly.
It's true.
No, but and when you get to Akudra, just it's so beautiful. I mean, the dedication, and it shows you it's a lifestyle living here. It's not just something which is put on. It's real. And I cycled a lot of people. The energy you get from those who go out there, and if you go in the evening, you see Sheikh Mohammed, basic cycling as well. It's amazing. There's no place in Dubai in the world can match what Dubai can offer.
Oh, I'm so glad that you've called at home for. Well, to see you around town, to eat your food, and it's wonderful to see people being recognised for all that hard graft. My last question to you is, we're asking everyone to get in touch today and let us know, how do you say beautiful in your native language? Now, you're Nigerian-born, London, you've got a French wife. So tell me, in Nigerian, how do you say the word beautiful?
You know, I was when I was listening, I was saying, I should say my native tongue, my first mother tongue is Igbo, yeah, because in Nigeria we have three major tribes, is Hausa, Yoruba, and Igbo. And in Igbo, we say Imaka.
Imaka.
Imaka, meaning you're beautiful. Yeah.
Back at you,
Chef.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for time. We'll let you back, get back to the kitchen, the office, the bike. I know you're always all over the place, but huge congratulations, honestly.
I'm in my new project, Kitchen, which is the online place. So it's a great project to launch, to show that eating out or eating at home or eating fast food could be slow, because the philosophy behind what we're doing here is all about the honesty of the ingredients. It's not about trying to contrive it or trying to mask it. So, yeah, but also, Helen, I'll get in contact with you to let you know there's something beautiful coming. I'm looking really excited
you
for that.
You better tell us here first, yeah. At Dubai Eye Chef. Thank you so much and congrats again. Have a great day.
Thank you very much.
All the best. There you go, Chef Izuani, got that golden 10-year visa and teaching us some of his native tongue too.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing some challenges now, though, with Anne Edmondson, the chairwoman of Golf for Good, because things are amping up. Do you fancy ascending 2,909 stairs to level 160 of the Burj Khalifa? You could be doing that and indeed heading abroad this year, taking on some challenges for, yes, good. And thank you so much for being with us. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Before we start, actually, Helen, I must just say that I was listening earlier when you were talking about the word beauty. Do you know what we say in Northern Ireland for somebody who's beautiful?
Well, my mum's from Northern Ireland, so I should know this. But no, I don't. What would you say?
She's a wee cracker.
She's a wee cracker. That's lovely. I like that. I'll say it to my mum. Oh, and then but in our family, like, all right, big man. Like that kind of like a wee man and big man. Yeah. So she's a wee cracker. So she is. Well, you are a cracker and lovely to have you with us today. Now, people might be thinking that hiking season is coming to an end and Golf for Good, I know your season has closed, but there are some options both indoors and further afield if you want to be raising some money for some great causes. So really just want to put some things in people's diaries, to be honest, Anne. Let's start with May. You're doing the virtual Burj Khalifa climb. How do we do it virtually? Tell us more.
So we started this last year during lockdown, and it was absolutely amazing. It was the first thing that Golf for Good had done virtually, and we weren't sure how it would go. But in fact, it just really appealed to people around the world. And so we got leading tower runners joining us from Mexico and from China and from Hong Kong, Singapore. It was absolutely amazing. And what everybody was doing was running up there, up and down their back, the stairs of their flats. Or in for a lot of people who were at home in Dubai, we were running up and down our villas, getting ourselves very dizzy. But this year, thankfully in Dubai, we have a bit more freedom. So people can go out and just walk the same number of steps. If you can do the stairs, that is much better. If you've got stairs where you live, then try it that way. It's 100 dirhams to participate. And all the funds are going to our charity project in Kyrgyzstan, where we're going in July. So that kind of kicks off that challenge for us.
I'm going to be doing it. Now, I live in, I don't know, is bungalow known as a phrase worldwide? We call our house the one-story glory because we've got, you know, it's one story. So I've got five stairs outside our house that lead up to our front door. But I'm determined to make friends with a hotel GM somewhere in Dubai so I can use their stairs and have a crack at this in May. When is the actual, is it a one-day thing or can people do it over a number of days, Anne, for the Burj Khalifa climb?
So the actual climb is on Saturday, the 22nd of May. But if that is not available for people because they're working or they've got something else on, they can do it any time over the weekend, basically. But that's when the main bulk of people will be trying to do the climb. And we've also got some of our climbers or tar runners, I should call them, are attempting a world record. So it's actually going to be really exciting. So if you can do it on the day, you can come along to our launch, which will be virtual, of course, on Zoom. That would be really fun. So you just join up on Gulf of Good website.
Brilliant. 100 dirhams to go there. So from sweaty staircases to stunning glaciers, where are you guys heading in July? And is it too late for someone else to come on board and take on a challenge and raise some funds?
No, it's definitely not too late. I mean, we're only in April now and we're heading off in July. We try to say to people, look, give yourselves 3 months to train for a demanding challenge like Kyrgyzstan is. So if you're somebody who's in reasonable fitness and you can get out and about and do some walking, do some stair climbing, we offer at Gulf of Good, even though our hiking season is now finished, we have got other trainings every weekend in life. So again, you just have to join through our website, and then that gives you access to everything that we've got going on. It's going to be an insane challenge. I'm going on that one actually, and I'm so excited to go. It's going to be wild and wonderful, and the scenery will be spectacular. So I really encourage anybody who's had enough of being locked down, stuck in Dubai, to think about coming on this one. It's very, very affordable. It is an open country right now. They've really not been affected in the same way as many other countries sadly have been. So we know that we can go there. So it's the 2nd to the 10th of July. And for me, it's amazing because I finished teaching on the 1st. And off I go.
Off you go. Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be thinking about getting active away from the gym and doing it to raise some much needed funds. So you can check all of those out at gulfforgood.org, and that's Gulf 4 with the number 4. And Anne, I will be picking your brains on stair climbing tips very, very soon indeed. Have to get those aching knees moving. Thanks, Anne. Take care. So it's gulfforgood.org. You can check them out, the charity challenges and the virtual challenges too.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're talking modest fashion today with Hafsa Lodi, the author of Modesty, a Fashion Paradox. She's appeared at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. It is a booming industry, a thriving niche estimated to be worth more than $402 billion by 2024, an increase of more than 51% from 2015. Hafsa, thank you so much for being with us. Before we start talking fashion, where are you from and how would you say beautiful?
Thank you for having me, Helen. Can you hear me all right?
Yep. Clear as well.
I'm originally from Pakistan and we would say khubsurat.
Khubsurat. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay, perfect.
Khubsurat, yeah.
So how long have you been in the UAE for?
I've been in the UAE for about 16 years now.
And as I said, you've written this book called Modesty, a Fashion Paradox. Before we get into your interest in it and even the business side of modest fashion, plus opinions coming in on 4001, how would you describe modest fashion? For anyone who's never heard that phrase before, could you describe it?
Yeah, of course. So, of course, modesty is very subjective, depending on personal preferences and culture and religion. But I generally define modest fashion as clothing that covers the shoulders, often up to the wrists, and covers the knees, often up to the ankles. It is not transparent and it is not skin tight, and necklines are not plunging. That's kind of a generic modest fashion guideline.
So around coverage and silhouette. And what do you think, Hafsa, are some of the big misconceptions around modest fashion?
There are a bunch. I mean, one of the biggest misconceptions around modest fashion is that it's religious, that modest fashion is Islamic fashion or, you know, Orthodox Jewish fashion or something like that. But it's not cult-like. religious group fashion. Modesty is really popular among non-religious women as well, people who don't ascribe to any faith. So while there are many women who dress modestly for faith-based reasons, the modest fashion movement we're witnessing right now globally is not about religious fashion.
I think that's a really, really good point to make. And I'd love to get everyone's thoughts on this today. Where do you kind of fall in that scale? Zina, we were just talking about this last week. I have been, I'm going to sound so ranty, but you know what? I've got the power of the microphone and I'm not afraid to use it. I have seen some, honestly, I've been in Dubai 14 years now, and I've seen some pretty out there outfits, both, you know, out and about. But honestly, I was leaving a mall, which will remain nameless, last week, and the outfits I saw coming out, I think I did that kind of draw on the floor thing. It was basically swimwear at 11 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, it's Ramadan. I mean, is it just me? Is anyone else seeing this and being somewhat outraged, to be honest?
Well, there are reminders, right, at mall entrances.
Yes.
And, you know, big commercial establishments. So I think people should be aware of that.
Especially at this time of year. And I don't know if it's through lack of education or lack of respect, but I feel like especially during Ramadan, this is something we need to remember, that we're a guest in a country. And if anyone out there is going out when, oh my goodness, yeah, I'm going to have to try and be very careful. But please, just be respectful. What about you, Hafsa? What are you seeing around town?
Yeah, I've also noticed this. To read something really quickly from a website called guidetodubai.com, if that's okay.
Yes.
It's just a quick guideline of dressing modestly. So when I moved to Dubai, 15 years ago, and when I went to high school here, we used to sometimes walk to the mall after school. And if we came straight from PE class, we'd be in our shorts. And oftentimes we would get tickets handed out if our shorts were above the knee. So like, it was really enforced 10 years ago, kindly enforced, politely enforced. You would get a little ticket or a warning if you were not abiding by the mall's dress codes. But as you said, those dress codes seem to have really laxened in the past few months, especially around this time. I've also noticed a lot of women, like you said, kind of looking like they were in swimwear or even like gymming clothes, but, you know, straight from the gym, like sports bra and leggings. I've had a friend who's witnessed this at pickup time when she's picking up her children from school, that these moms will sometimes, you know, go into the school properties also, you know, dressed from the gym. And it's really different from what we'd witnessed 10, 15 years ago as expats here. So this is what guidetodubai.com said in 2019. It said, to be respectful of the UAE culture, it is best to remain covered from shoulder at least to the knees. For instance, although T-shirts, preferably with sleeves covering at least upper arm, are fine, spaghetti tops for women may not be appreciated in public areas. Also, very tight or low-cut T-shirts are considered offensive. Females wearing strappy tops may be in for a warning at shopping malls or shopping centers. And I'd say that these guidelines have been pretty stretched in the past few years.
I saw a lady at the airport recently, and I saw her at the other side, and I was like, surely she's going to put a T-shirt on before we arrive in Dubai. No. It was almost medical, let's just say. Hafsa, thank you so much for being with us today. We'd love to get your thoughts on this 4001, and you can, of course, use the ARN Play app. It's certainly not around shaming anyone in their choices, but simply being respectful, especially at this time of year. Hafsa, I'm curious, what kind of trends are you seeing in this growing movement? We're seeing Western brands responding. I've seen dedicated areas in stores, online collections from the likes of H&M, Marks and Spencer's, Uniqlo in the US and the UK. This is big business, right?
Definitely. I mean, it's a $402 billion business. I think you mentioned that earlier. And basically, all of these financial projections have come out, which have shown that Muslim consumers have really high spending power, especially the younger ones. So millennials. And so all of these Western retailers have really started scrambling to attract this spending power. H&M, Marks and Spencer's, Mango, Michael Kors, Carolina Herrera, all these luxury brands and high street retailers in the West from Europe and America have started creating these dedicated Ramadan collections during the holy month. They've started doing kind of year-round modest lines and modest edits in their stores. I know Primark in the UK did one last year, I think for the second time. I mean, really any big retailer in a major city is definitely being more modest, inclusive in their ranges.
And that's not out of any kind of religious or cultural sensitivities. This is because people are spending. You know, they're very much thinking about the bottom line.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing modest fashion this afternoon with something of an expert in this. We're delighted to be welcoming Hafsa Lodhi, the author of a book called Modesty, a Fashion Paradox. It is a booming business, projected to be worth more than $402 billion by 2024. We're seeing Western brands such as Mango, Marks & Spencer's, Uniqlo, H&M, all getting on board this bandwagon, not just to offer something to those who choose to dress modestly, but certainly thinking about the bottom line and that big business too. We want to know, what are you thinking around modest fashion? Are you like me and have noticed around Dubai some, well, less than respectful outfits? Kathy is saying, you are so right, Helen. So many people dressing very irresponsibly. Beachwear worn in supermarkets, malls and everywhere. My Emirati friends are shocked at these sights. Security guards are nervous to address it. And male friends have also commented negatively. Thank you for addressing this topic. And it's certainly not about shaming anyone and their fashion choices. But please remember, especially during Ramadan, that you are a guest so often in this country. So please do adhere to regulations and to modesty, to being respectful. Hafsa, I've got lots of questions for you. And one's come in from Fleur saying, I'd love some Instagrammers to follow. And recently converted, I love a loose silhouette, but need some colour and shopping inspiration. When we're talking about big brands coming on board, presumably fashion shows and influencers follow as well. So what are some of your favourite accounts when it comes to modest fashion?
I'd love to just mention that after launching the book, we've just launched a website called Modestish. It's an online content hub and lifestyle platform for anyone interested in modest fashion. It's modest.ish on Instagram. And we're reposting a lot of these really inspirational outfits from influencers and celebrities and, you know, any regular women who are dressing modestly, with kind of style tips and trends and all of these different kind of news from different collection drops in modest fashion. So that's all on Modestish on Instagram, modest.ish.
Great one. So that's all in one
place. And online we have a lot of interviews with these women. What does modesty mean to them? What are their favorite trends? And of course, these aren't just Muslim women. These aren't just women in the Middle East. These are women from across the globe, different religions. So we're really trying to cultivate a community of like-minded women who ascribe to modesty in whatever kind of shape or size or form that may take.
Brilliant. Thank you so, so much. No Name Wilson saying, I like modest fashion. I'm so over, quote, sexy fashion. Modest is cool. So what about fashion shows? I know obviously things are on a bit of a pause right now, but what? How are the fashion capital of the world sitting up and paying notice?
So in the past five, six years, we've definitely seen more modesty on runways. And just even from their models, we've seen more hijabi models on runways, which is crazy. If thinking 10 years ago, you would have never imagined you would see a hijab wearing woman of color as a model on a runway. So, you know, with Halima Aden, who was kind of the pioneering face of modest modeling, when she broke through at New York Fashion Week for Kanye West's Yeezy show, there's a bunch of other modest models on runways, hijabi, non-hijabi, Dolce & Gabbana, Gucci, Max Mara, Michael Kors. These are all Tommy Hilfiger. I mean, every brand is really paying attention to this demographic now. There's definitely, the runways are definitely taking notice. But at the same time, fashion is all about seasonal trends. Things come into fashion, go out of fashion. So while modesty may be trending right now as a buzzword, it's not necessarily a new era in fashion. There are also other trends such as, a midriff-bearing top, cycling shorts, other, I don't want to say non-modest because I don't think that's a good term to use. I think modest is a good descriptor to use for conservative clothing, but it's not the only sort of clothing out there that's trending.
So thank you so much for your time today. Your book is available, Modesty, a Fashion Paradox. What's the best way of getting hold of that?
Thank you. It's available at Tanya's Tea House in Dubai. It's also available at Magoodi's and Kinokuniya and online through Amazon.ae.
Brilliant. Really appreciate your time and your insights today.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
talking freelancing this afternoon. Speaking now to Felice Hurst, advisor to the Work Crowd, a platform that started in the UK and will soon be available here in Dubai. It connects freelancers with jobs and it's proving to be a huge success, especially during the pandemic. Thank you so much for being with us. This is a topic really close to my heart. A lot of my friends are freelancers, and me being a journalist, you know, it does tend to be the creative fields that, you know, have traditionally lent themselves to freelancing. But we are seeing a big shift in this. And I'd love to get your take on this, Felice, about why do you think freelancing is on the up?
Yeah, well, hi, Helen, and everybody there. There's been such a massive uptake in this. I mean, there were recently, a couple of years ago, McKinsey did some research into the global freelance market. And they estimated it to be worth something in the region of $2.7 trillion by 2025 alone. I mean, it's huge. And they're anticipating 50% of the workforce will be freelancing. Google are already leading the way with 50% of the workforce already working independently. So before we'd even got to the pandemic, this was becoming the gig economy, the future of the work, of the way we work, and why so many people are now freelancing. And then, of course, we've hit the pandemic, which made it even more accessible.
Well, it does. And, you know, using Google there as an example, but when we think about big corporations who've traditionally said, you know, we need bums on seats, we need people to be present, to be productive. And what we're now seeing is people looking to cut costs and maybe take out salaried workers and instead bring in freelancers for project-based work. And people are seeing, you know, ultimately what flexible working can be like, you know, some of the upsides of that. Millennials, and I am an elder millennial, I've snuck in 1982.
Oh,
but younger millennials seem to be putting a really big emphasis on that work-life balance and wanting to work on projects or for companies that align with their values, that get them really excited, and wanting to, you know, enjoy themselves away from, I was going to say 9 to 5, but, you know, for many people, it's more like 8 to 8. So what about here in the UAE? Where are we at now, do you think?
Well, we've seen such a change. I mean, anyway, you look at a shrinking workforce. We saw this in 2008, 2009. Obviously, we're now seeing it here. Businesses are looking to access talent, but are afraid to put the investment into hiring, especially here in this region. We've got gratuity and visas, etc. So as businesses are coming out, and we in the UAE, as we can all see, I mean, everybody is massively busy in the workforce. Rather than going out and actively hiring, people are looking for this more flexible economy that can come in and plug and play. And so, I mean, the Work Crowd was launched in the UK in 2013. We've just literally brought the platform here, and we are looking to launch. Head office will be over here, because we now have freelance visas as well. So we have seen an appetite for this. And just on this time last year, 50% increase on freelancers joining the platform. And the last couple of months alone, because we've now arrived in the region, there's a massive uptake, massive appetite for all these very skilled people that are looking to work independently or maybe adding on a bit more. I mean, everyone's at home beginning to go back to the workforce, and it's changing the way everybody is looking. You can be an independent worker. You can set up your own agency. And then as long as you've got the access to the talent to enable this.
So let's talk industries then. As I said, you know, traditional freelance professions are things like marketing, comms, journalists, graphic design. Are you seeing those industries and those job titles changing?
I mean, I Googled this before just to have out of interest to see what are the top 10 freelancers at the moment. I mean, it's always traditionally been genetically marketing sort of functions, technology and digital. I mean, if you were to go back 10 years, a marketer or marketing role was more along events. Now, when you look at the structure of a marketer, it's paid analytics, paid advertising, creative, TikTok users, etc., etc. And all around the world, there are experts who specialize in those specific fields. So when you Google, they're saying number one, program and software development, number two, social video marketing, number three, website design, number four, content, graphic design. We as a platform, because we specialize in marketing communications, we're really on a big drive now. Social media, that seems to be one of the biggest drivers of projects going onto the platform. How can businesses access that global market?
I've listened to a fantastic podcast recently, which was talking about how to get noticed. And we're going to be talking a little bit about the platform. But you were mentioning there about, you know, SEO and software developers. Mm-hmm. And it was a guy who was two examples. One was a guy who decided to leave his agency, go freelance, but because he didn't have a degree, he wasn't going through a lot of the traditional recruitment filters. He was simply being taken out because he didn't have the level of education. So what he decided to do was, in his particular city, he identified some of the people that he wanted to work with. And he basically targeted them. So every time that they Googled their name or they Googled their company, his would be the first option that came up on the SEO, which was like, you know, "Hi, Helen Farmer. I am so-and-so. You need to speak to me." So he basically identified about 20 people that he wanted to work with. And within a week, had heard from four of them. And within that same week, had got a job from one of them, which I thought was a really, really great way of doing it. The other example was, again, when it came to web. And it was someone who, and not everyone will have the time to do this, of course, but someone who was a website developer, and she simply emailed companies that she wanted to work with on a freelance basis, project basis, and said, "This is how I'd redesign your homepage. This is what it would look like." And people who perhaps had never even considered refreshing it, you know, looking at different branding, looking at even the user experience, started paying her money and thought, you know what, fresh eyes and great initiative, great work ethic. And I think being proactive is just so, so crucial, especially now. You know, you cannot rest on your laurels at all. And I love the sound.
And that's the freelancer and the businesses, though. It goes both ways. Mm-hmm. You know, you as a business holder, if you're not being reactive, you're not being proactive rather than just reactive, you know, you will cut out this economy. I mean, this is what we're seeing time and time again. These sorts of, I mean, we as a business, the SEOs are what drives our business. You know, we you know, this, and that's where they're so important moving forward.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Felice Hirst joining us this afternoon, advisor to The Work Crowd, a platform that's launching soon here in the UAE for freelancers. So can you tell us, Felice, how it works? What is the platform all about?
So the platform was first set up to really, you know, utilise and work with all of these enormous amounts of freelancers globally. It's the looking at a problem and rectifying how do we connect businesses with the talent that they need, and at the same time helping people to find work that works for them. So, and the biggest problem that freelancers have is they're looking to connect and collaborate, and that is what the Work Crowd is striving to do. So it's a place to, for you as a freelancer, it's your business development, it's your invoicing, it's your community, it's your conversation. As a project holder, it's somewhere to go to access this talent. So it's been established for a number of years in the UK, and the algorithm and the technology is award-winning. And we've just last week launched the .ae platform here. So it's smart, it's quick, and it's accessible.
Can I ask, how does it work with things like pricing and making sure you get paid? Because presumably people with different levels of experience and expertise and, well, quality of work, what freedom do you have to set your own rates?
So it's all depicted and decided by you. So every freelancer that registers on the platform, there is an account manager that will help you upload and onboard onto there. So it all depends on you and your specific day rates. The charge goes to the project holder, and it's just over the day rate. So it will depend, you decide, depending on the length of the project. Is it a long-term one? Is it a one? It's all individual. So the project will be posted on the platform. It will match up with the individual freelancers with the right skills, be them based here or the digital nomads that could be sat at the top of Timbuktu. It would all depend on the project. You know, do you need to be on the ground in the office, or can you be totally remote, which is the future of work? But the day rates are all dependent on you as a freelancer.
So how does the platform make money? I'm just trying to understand. So freelancers presumably don't pay to join. Nope. So how does it work in terms of your business model? Who do you take a fee from?
We take a fee from the project holder. So it's a percentage on top of the agreed day rates. And it's 15% that we've got offers on at the moment. We are possibly looking at changing to more of a subscription model further down the line, but this is the way that we, at the moment, it's really working, because it's ease and it's very cost effective, and it should be an immediate connection.
Now, speaking as a former freelancer, I had Excel spreadsheets that honestly made my head want to fall off. And I think anyone who has worked for themselves, whether that's a freelancer or as a business owner, there is always something to do. You're chasing the work, you're doing the work, you're chasing payment for the work, you're chasing payment again for the work. So how does it work then in terms of invoicing? Is that built in?
It's all built into the platform. The invoicing is with templates there for you. It's all tracked through the platform. So you as a freelancer can go on to your page at any time and see who owes you money, how much you earned last year, who are your clients that you've worked with over the last few years, and of course the other way around. As we are based in the UK, we do offer escrow as well. So it means that this is the biggest issue freelancers always come up with: I don't get paid. It's only just recently been legitimised in the UAE here, and it's still quite a grey area. So we are wanting to work with all the different free zones to make this a professional. You know, you can be a professional freelancer even in the UAE. But we do have the escrow in the UK. Once we launch here, this is something we're looking into. But obviously, it's modernising the banking systems here, which is a whole other conversation.
I'll leave that to the business breakfast. Yeah. Can I just ask, we've had a number of messages saying, when's it starting and what's the website? So able to address both of those.
It literally launched last week. So we hosted our first webinar the other a couple of weeks ago. We've got another one in the next few weeks. We've got continual workshops and all sorts on there. So it's theworkcrowd.ae. So we've seen lots of rise going up. There's lots of it on Instagram at the moment. And if anybody wants to get in touch with me, obviously please do. But it's here. Brilliant. So get on the platform.
Great to have this conversation and perhaps give people some pause for thought about what options are available to them. Please, thank you so, so much for your time this afternoon. The website again is theworkcrowd.ae.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking careers this afternoon, and so many people have found themselves in circumstances they never could have predicted over the course of the last few years. And while freelancing has traditionally been the domain of people like me, journalists or graphic designers, more and more industries and indeed jobs are lending themselves to this. The low costs of hiring project-based work, we're seeing more and more people really kind of broadening out their projects, their range, their locations, and working on a freelance basis, effectively running a business of one where they are the commodity. To tell us more about the legalities, licensing, and the bit of the basics really on how to get started, delighted to be joined by Toby Simpson. He's the CEO of the Striver app. To give us some insights from an employment point of view about what's happening in the market and how to really get your foot in the door. Some of the do's and don'ts, and even some of the big questions like, can you poach clients from your old job? Toby, thank you so much for joining us. I know you have your own business, which in some ways is kind of like being a freelancer.
It's a bit different. It has its massive benefits. The lower amount of meetings is an absolute plus. You know, you do miss out on the camaraderie of the office. I can't say I totally love the insular lifestyle. I don't miss the Sheikh Zayed Road every morning, that's for sure.
Well, I was freelance before joining Dubai Eye for a couple of years, simply because I was editing a magazine and tried to do that with a young baby, tried to do it part-time, and it just wasn't possible. So went freelance writing, doing some broadcasting, blogging. Again, massive, massive pluses in the sense that I could, you know, work during nap times. I could, you know, manage my own workload. I could work with people and on projects that I was interested in and politely decline or put up my rates for people that I wasn't so interested in working with. As you mentioned, what I struggled with a little bit was that social side, and ended up working from a number of cafes where there were people in a similar position to me. So I had the camaraderie from people who perhaps were also freelance writers or in marketing or graphic design or social media, who understood the challenges of that freelance life, and we were able to bounce ideas off each other. But it's not necessarily always possible. For some people, this is a total lifestyle. You could be a full-time freelancer and you could be working from, you know, a treetop hotel in Bali one week, and then you could be, you know, in a skyscraper on Sheikh Zayed Road the next. That nomadic lifestyle is certainly something that more and more millennials seem to be drawn to. So if anyone's thinking about going freelance, and as I said, that could be a lifestyle decision, it could be wanting to fit around other work and having that kind of gig economy mindset, or it could be because of job loss. What do you need in order to start in terms of licenses here in the UAE?
Well, you do need a license, and the good news is that originally it was very much for technology or media types, and now it's much broader, and there's many, many free zones across the UAE, as well as, you know, onshore in Dubai, and I believe in Abu Dhabi as well, where you can get a license relatively easily. It's, you know, it's always been the process, you know, even for setting up a company is pretty straightforward, but the freelancing situation does look incredibly efficient, and low cost, from what I've seen, between 7,500 a year to 15,000 a year, which is, you know, for most professions, deeply affordable.
And that's if you need a visa. If you obviously on a spouse's visa, then you are really just looking at pure business license, which can be as low as kind of 1,200 dirhams and turned around quite quickly. One thing I wanted to ask you is about that cash flow, because that was something I not so much struggled with, but you get used to having X amount coming into your account every month when you are a salaried employee, and then suddenly to go working for yourself, whether that's starting your own business or working as a freelancer, you haven't got that amount that you can count on and that you can plan with. And you know, I was fortunate that my husband was still in a salaried job, but if you are on your own or you're the sole income to your house, what advice would you give there in terms of the sheer logistics of working with a kind of the finances of freelancing?
People have an optimistic out view and always a surprise when things go wrong. And there's a paradigm here that when you're within a company, there is a certain loyalty towards you. There's a certain duty of care from the employer to support their employees, to look after their employees. But you don't have that emotional or contractual connection with that particular company if you are a freelancer. It is important to be careful. You know, I think one of the good things to do, and you have a situation where economies tend to be, or certainly recently, perhaps over the past decade, a lot more volatile than they have been in the past. So you can't count on a resurgence lasting for too much longer. You can't count on a particular sector being buoyant in one particular area or a particular demand of skills for a long time. So where possible, it's that fiscal discipline to have an accruals model. So you always have 6 months of not just your everyday running costs, but you know, you also, in this sort of situation, you need to pay for your own health insurance, which is a lot more expensive than it would be when issued by the employer. And that sort of thing comes up once a year. So it's important that you already have, you know, if you're halfway through the year, you've kind of saved at least 6 months towards that and have that sitting there. And then don't go out on lavish parties or boat cruises or go and buy that swanky dress or pair of chinos you've had your eye on or whatever it might be, you know, until you've reached that kind of level of security in your bank balance.
It's interesting you mentioned both loyalty there and the medical side, because when you are on a project basis or you're on a retainer, there's no sick leave, there's no holiday leave, and that's something else that you need to be working into your annual plans and spend, really. If you're taking a holiday, it's days when you are not earning. So it's almost like a double hit. You're spending and you're not making any cash.
Unless you're an Instagram star, of course.
Yeah, it helps. And in terms of, well, those outgoings, you're talking there about the visa, the medical insurance. Are there any kind of hidden costs we might not be aware of, like other types of insurance or places to work from? What else do we need to be aware of when starting from scratch?
Well, certain types of profession, and these professions be well aware of it, would require professional indemnity insurance, or should at least be considering professional indemnity insurance. You're not being paid during your holiday, so you need to factor that in. If you want to go away in the summer for a month, you need to factor that in to, you know, building that pot up. There's going to be no income over that period, and these sorts of things are, you know, important. There are always surprises in cost. So, you know, having a line for contingencies in that accrual model is you know, perhaps very sensible.
Now, network is probably more important than ever right now, Toby, and there's perhaps not as many networking, you know, physical events going on, more being taken online and certainly on LinkedIn. So my question is, you've decided to start from scratch. You want to make an announcement that, you know, Helen Freelance Inc. is now open for business. How do you start to get your first few clients? Can you legally, ethically contact people that you might have worked with in the past through your old employer, for example? Where do you get that first, hopefully, bit of cash coming in from?
Well, we'll start with the poaching bit. So the legal and ethical things are somewhat different. Now, I've been through this, and I don't know if the law has you know, has been updated since these days, but we hired an individual to work on a certain account. We already had that account, but the employer they were leaving were claiming that they were poaching that account across, and letters were exchanged, that sort of thing. The advice I got at the time was that in the UAE specifically, intellectual property belongs to the individual, not the company. And this would deem to be the case in the instance of working with a company at the same time. Now, however, if you have any ongoing contractual responsibilities, including your notice period to your employer, then it's deemed as moonlighting and it is a criminal offence. You need to toe that line very carefully. But I think it's very rare that these things go to a legal level. But what's important is this is still it's a relatively close-knit community. It's a relatively close-knit industry, and particularly within specific industries, everybody knows each other. So if you go and do something that is obviously ethically not correct, you know, that will resound throughout your career potentially. There's always that adage that one bit of bad news, you know, takes 10 bit of good news to fix.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking freelancing with Toby Simpson, CEO of Striver. And one of the things you need to keep in mind if you want to freelance is networking. But not all of us find it easy.
People are petrified of networking. It's the big mental barrier to actually jumping out there and doing it yourself. It's all, you know, how would I go and win work? You see people's reactions when you know they turn up to these conferences, you know, events, whatever it might be, of kind of very stiltedly putting forward a business card, and there's those nerves in their eyes. And I think it's really hard for everybody. But the most successful way, as ever, is if you're good at your job, ask for referrals. And I think particularly within this, you know, within this community, while we are always looking, we trust the opinions of those around us. Your WASTA is kind of a big deal, but that's the easiest way to go about it, and it's probably the most successful as well.
What about where jobs are advertised? You know, we're seeing through traditional job sites, through LinkedIn, and through social media as well. You know, your normal, this is going to be X number of dirhams per month, but also some freelance jobs being offered, or even in brackets, also, you know, freelance also, you know, could be discussed. Is there any way you'd recommend freelancers having a look, either here or indeed internationally, given the nature of freelance business?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's a really good point before you start to see what the potential demand might be by actually going out onto these sites and seeing what's there. So there's, I believe, Expertin, and there's of course Upwork as well, and that's a really good starting point for due diligence on whether you want to do this. And, you know, I've used it before. I've bought graphic design, more sort of personal fun stuff than anything business related. But I'm amazed the quality of work that came back and the variety of people on offer. So it is a potentially, you know, a very valuable asset to both the economy and to those individuals in it. You know, the flexibility to be able to, you know, engage individuals outside of big corporate structure creates efficiency, it creates competition in the market, and ultimately it's very good for the long-term sustainability of Dubai's economy.
I wanted to ask you, Toby, about setting rates. How do you know what your time is worth, to be honest? Because we might be looking at, say, 8 to 10 hours a day on a monthly basis that would perhaps cover health insurance and blah, blah, blah. But then how do you then break down your time when you are starting as a freelancer from nothing? Is there a cheeky way of finding out what other people are charging? Ultimately, when you start giving quotes out, it can be a very quick way to end a potentially, you know, fruitful and interesting discussion about working together.
There's that imbalance of you know, what the market offers and actually what you need. So when you've been an employee and you're used to getting a salary, and you have a certain level of lifestyle that you'd like to maintain or even improve on, you need to work out that it's not just, can't just be charging based on your hourly rate that you earn as a full-time employee, because there will be a lot of downtime. And not only will there be a lot of downtime, but you need to factor in the additional cost that you didn't have before into that equation. But also, I think if you've been in a particular industry, for example, if you're in tax, you know what the client has charged for your work directly to those companies. So, you know, and there's a comfort of working with, for example, I don't know, Top Four. So there's a brand equity in there that you wouldn't expect to be able to charge the same amount, because there is that level of brand equity and support and, you know, kind of, you know, all the resources those particular firms would have. So you really need to factor that in. You understand your client. At what price point do you think that you would still be competitive against both traditional and non-traditional methods of solving whatever problem they want solved?
It's a really hard one, because what we see a lot of, and certainly in some of the kind of industry sites that I'm on Facebook and online as well, is people who will set their rates super low because they want to be getting money in, they want to be getting referrals, they want to get a body of work that they can use for portfolio. And it's a very quick way to annoy other freelancers in a similar industry. And everyone affects. It is. People are like, please don't do this for free. What you're charging is unrealistic. You know, you're basically messing with the whole ecosystem of freelancing, because then other people need to start lowering their costs because everyone's just undercutting each other. So knowing your value from the outset is so, so key. I think much better to put things perhaps on the high side and let a client negotiate down than for them. There's nothing worse than getting that email back going, yep, rate sounds great, let's start tomorrow. And you kind of go, did I accidentally leave a zero off the quote that I just provided? And it's much easier to to negotiate than it is to perhaps shock regular clients with increases down the line when you look at what's coming in and go, do you know what, I actually can't afford to pay rent on what I've been quoting.
What you'll find is if you do a good piece of work, that first client you've signed up for a marginal fee, everyone always thinks, oh, you know, I'll prove the value of my work and I'll be able to up my rates later. Now, for many, many years and many grey hairs, I found that when you set a rate with clients, it's very, very rare that you ever get them to pay more in the future. More likely, they're going to try and squeeze you some point down the line for X, Y, and Z reason, competition, you know, whatever it might be.
Great pointers there from Toby Simpson, weighing the pros and cons of going freelance, what you need to know, the hidden costs. It's not an easy route to take, but if done right, huge rewards, including owning your time.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is time for Money Diaries and delighted to be welcoming to the show the General Manager of Times Square Centre. It's Nancy Osbeck. She has decades of experience in the retail industry and a lot of experience when it comes to some adventurous pursuits as well. A busy working mum, I'm going to be picking her brains on how she spends and saves and some advice to her younger self as well. But Nancy, before we talk money, I need to pick your brains on a personal basis because I understand that you have been exploring the world and exploring some heights. You were a triathlete Olympian and you've even climbed Kilimanjaro, which I'm hoping to do in October. So I'd love your advice, please, for scaling summits. What do I need to know before putting on my hiking boots in Tanzania?
My passion is taking part in triathlon, hiking and being active in this life. And, you know, the best thing always I have been told, planning is the most important thing. Whatever you will do, you will prepare yourself for a race or you will go to Kilimanjaro, plan and equipment. This is the best thing. Once you have plan, you will be successful. This you can follow this rule anywhere in your home when you are running with your kids, when you are running your time with your relation and when you are doing your business.
Fail to plan is planning to fail is really like my dad's top scout sayings. So where did you grow up, Nancy? And what was the attitude around money and spending when you were a child?
Actually, I have been grown in Turkey and I study in Turkey and I'm coming from mid-income level of people. But my family spent all their money for my education. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to do for my kids, to be honest. I was a good student and I studied economic. And then, of course, you know, like any young body, I was looking for exotic places like Dubai. Dubai were offering a lot of opportunity. When you are coming from mid-income family and you would like to come out from that.
So with all your studying as a teen, did you have time to have a part-time job? Can you remember what your first job was?
The minute I started university, I did not take pocket money from my dad. And as I said, I was studying economy and I was giving math class to younger kids. And I was arranging my pocket money. That money is a great money for a student. Mm-hmm. And also, I was really lucky one. I got a scholarship from Turkish Trade Center and in Turkey. So I spent all over my time with these good opportunities around me.
And what was your attitude to spending and saving then? And how has it changed, do you think, now, 20
you know,
years later?
Even, let me say, you know, I always, when I was younger, earlier than 40, let me say, I was trying to save 60%.
Wow.
And I was spending 40. And now I am giving, advice to my kids. Save 40, spend 60 at early age. Because, you know, that is the time you see lots of opportunity. Your body is young. And if you ask me after 20 years, I cannot go and climb certain mountains. Always save, but 40, 60. What I've done, 60% I save because I was coming from mid-income level people. I don't want to have the difficulty that they had.
I think, you know, the lessons we teach our kids, we all want to have the honest discussions, but we also want to kind of shelter them from the realities of grown-up life. And you know, when to introduce pocket money is something that we're thinking about now. My kids are 4 and 6. How old are your kids and what have you decided about that?
Actually, yes, I give them pocket money. They have to survive with that pocket money. If they come to me in additional money, no, I don't have money. I have very strict border over that because they have to learn how to manage themselves in-house. House education is very important in this field, in my opinion.
It sounds like you are very well organized and you have saving goals, but also like to enjoy yourself. Is there anything that when it comes to shopping, and it could be food or fashion or adventures, that you really don't mind spending on? You're happy to have a bit of a splurge?
to be honest, I love spending on my helmet, my gear for triathlon equipment, and for my kids. I have only one policy in this life. 5 days, I'm very careful, but 2 days, don't hold me. I will spend for anything. I will eat, drink, go exotic places, and spend time with my family.
And I wanted to get your take, really, on some of the businesses we're seeing popping up in Dubai, which has been amazing. We've seen record numbers of new businesses starting, which I think is really encouraging. I love supporting small businesses and especially fellow working mums. And in Times Square Centre, you know, you've got such a lovely mix of the brands, but also smaller companies and smaller labels that have come together. Why is that important to you to have that mix?
Firstly, I'm a strong supporter of female-led businesses and small businesses. I love their success stories. In Times Square Center, we have a vendor and they began selling products from a small stand or table and then move into larger stores because they have their own feeling into this business. We look at also this as a Times Square Center as a community policy. We love talking with community. If we see success story within our community, we become happier than these small businesses.
I love that. I think you're absolutely right. And I think Eggs and Soldiers is such a brilliant example, you know, and you're hosting some of the markets as well. It's become a real kind of hotspot for discovering local talent in small businesses.
Helen, when you talk about the small business and their success story in Times Square Center, trust me, my hair is up. I feel so much about them because, you know, to sit with them, to listen to their success stories is so important. In 22 years, I've seen many stories, but I noticed something when I'm dealing with these people. Dream is so important. Once you have a dream, this should have also a unique sales point. But this is not enough. You have to use your imagination and planning. And I always say that, net them out. Whoever comes to me, big or small, especially if it is woman, it's my favorite. And I don't want any woman to suffer in this life, to be honest. And I love seeing women successful. I tell them, net them your dream out down to the tiniest details, because this tiniest details will make your great business plan. And as long as you have plan, believe in it, and hard work will give you the results. This is also my passion.
I love this. So I think, you know, as you say, so many people have a great idea. They've got imagination, they've got creativity, but sometimes it can come down to the nuts and bolts of a business plan. And, you know, using the mall as an example, you know, knowing what to budget for rent, knowing, you know, basically what your offering can be to complement other stores in the mall. For anyone that is thinking about going into retail, and maybe that is, you know, a small fashion label, maybe it's food perhaps, or perhaps it's even taking over a spot in a mall, what advice do you think a successful shop owner or retail business needs to have at its very core?
Their plan is so important, not only as a conceptual plan and at the same time financial plan. Because, you know, what I saw from my experience, retailers, they come, they only think about rentals. They think, oh, okay, this rental is fine, I can pay this. But rental is nothing, to be honest. To start up business, financials are very important. Shop design, shop drawings, these are all expenses. And also, you know what they do? They go to cheaper designers. It's not working, Helen, because, you know, they miss something. And my father used to say, I'm not rich enough to buy a cheap product.
And I love that.
And make plan, do financial, get three quotation. This is the, you know, key of the success. Sit, think, as I said, tiniest details will help you.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
It is Monday where we talk career, we talk money, we talk finance, and in conversation with Nancy Osbeck, the GM of Times Square Centre. She's turned that space into a community mall, giving opportunities to women who have started their own enterprises, other working mums. So she wants that space to attract more people, for a more family feel. So she's been telling us about her plans, including a picnic square.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We look at our food court. To be honest, if you ask me, my food court was poor, and this is a time for us to change the picnic square. Because, you know, if we look at Dubai, we see many nationalities, Emiratis, Turkish, British, Dutch. The good things, we all love eating. And also, but we believe the best food are generally our homegrown food. And picnic is an activity all these nationalities had with their parents father, mother, neighbor, and they try to grow the best food, homegrown food. This is the idea we come up with Picnic Sıkar. We really trying to change our memorization about eating places because we really also tiniest detail are here at Picnic Sıkar. There will be picnic table, there will be picnic basket, and also well-taught private pots that mom can breastfeed or they can have some privacy in this area. Or you can come and you can have your business lunch and breakfast here at Times Square Center. That's why we are very excited at the moment, to be honest.
I love that you're thinking about these things because, you know, I'm past the feeding times, whether that was breast or bottle. But to have somewhere that just feels like a little bit of peace and quiet and feels like a safe space, it is so, so important. And you know, so many places fail to think about that, and I'm not going to name them on the radio. But it, you know, yeah. It, you know, whether, if you've got a crying toddler or a screaming baby, you know, you need to be able to find somewhere fast. Otherwise, you know, I remember heart starts pumping, you're worried about a nappy, you know, exploding everywhere. No one's yeah. having fun. The kids pick up on your anxiety and then the day is ruined. So anything that any retailers and more management out there can do to make parents' lives easier is going to be a big tick in the box for me. Nancy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Helen. It's really a pleasure for me and to talk with you. Thank you very much.
And I love this idea of, you know, women supporting women and that you're there as a resource and someone to answer questions for anyone who is thinking about dipping their toe into it.
Oh, yes, Helen. Thank you very much. Have a beautiful day.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.